Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Daily Briefing. It is Thursday, June 24th. Today, U.S. President Joe Biden announced progress on an infrastructure deal, but the bond market barely budged.
And the S&P and NASDAQ hit all-time highs, but could deflation be lurking? That's what one RV favorite says.
And also, very shortly, the U.S. Federal Reserve will announce results of its bank stress tests. All eyes are on this report. Will it pave the way for record buybacks?
And Tesla up nearly 10% in 2 days. Could this be a sign of reversal in sector rotation?
So much to talk about. Samuel, thanks for this. We are joined by our very own Ash Bennington. Ash, let's start out and focus on the infrastructure plan. Biden announced that a deal is made. But when you get into the details, you know, there's nowhere near as much sticker shock as there was with the $1.9 trillion plan, is there?
Well, details are a little fuzzy, I think, across the board. Obviously, we live in a time of great partisan rancor. And the question right now is, how is this infrastructure bill going to get paid for? That's a non-trivial question. President Biden, who obviously spent a great deal of time in the Senate, believes he's got the votes. We'll see.
Absolutely. I should add, President Biden believes that he should pay for it, which is a key distinction. He is not of the modern monetary theory MMT school. He believes it should be paid for by either by raising taxes or cutting spending elsewhere.
Ed Harrison point. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not a $1.9 trillion that was originally thought to be the infrastructure plan. Now it's announced it's $579 billion. Samuel, can you break this down for us?
Well, I think what's interesting here is that for a while, the Republicans had floated a gas tax, which would have been political suicide, maybe for the Republicans, but definitely for Joe Biden. You don't want to be in the White House and overseeing a gas tax if you want to stay in the goodwill of the people of the United States. But what really stood out to me was one number here, and that's the fact that even though we don't have all the details of the plan the way that Ash was signaling there, is that still people believe, it's estimated, that this will only be a 0.1% boost to GDP each year, and it would have to be very concentrated for there to be a big hit in the positive sense, a positive hit to the economy. It'd be very, very concentrated, but in reality, it looks like this is a multi-year plan. So in my estimation, when I look at these factors and the way that the market reacted, it looks like this was all pretty much built in, and you can't expect too much difference going into tomorrow, the next day, as a result of this.
Except we saw construction stocks rising pretty dramatically. Cat looks like it's up about 2.5. Caterpillar looks like it's up about 2.5% on the day. This is a low beta stock. Typically, the 5-year trailing beta on this is less than 1.092. So we're seeing some surge in construction stocks as a consequence.
Yeah, Vulcan Materials, too, another favorite of in the materials sector, up, I think, something where like 3.3%. Ash and Samuel, I'm just going to read a few details that were reported. $312 billion will go into transportation, $109 billion into roads, bridges, and major projects, and $66 billion in freight rail and $49 billion in public transit. Only $15 billion will go towards electric vehicle infrastructure, electric buses, and the sort. And Samuel and Ash, you know, I've been doing a fair number of interviews with people in the commodity sector, whether it's lithium or copper or rare earths for that matter. And the narrative over the past almost a year has been that this infrastructure bill is coming. We are going to, you know, electrify the entire grid. Everything is going to, you know, the government is going to pay for the electrification of everything. And that is going to require so much copper, so much lithium, so much neodymium, praseodymium, that it's going to blow your mind. So therefore, this commodity is something that's really good to invest in. Do you think that this stimulus bill with only $15 billion going towards electric vehicles. Do you think that kind of misses the mark for this commodity super cycle narrative?
Well, Ash, I'll jump in just quickly. I mean, this is the thing, is that so much of what they wanted to be in the bill isn't going to be there at the end of the day because they had to compromise. I mean, what I'm thinking about more than just those commodities is the fact that so much of this was supposed to go to really city and different municipality bailouts. And it doesn't look like that's going to be there at the end of the day, or at least in not a big enough scale that it's going to push the overall market up. So that's one thing that really stands out to me, Ash.
Yeah, you know, to be honest, I think you're spot on, Samuel. It's very early. We don't actually know what the bill is going to contain yet, other than the market signaling a rise in construction stocks. I think I'm probably keeping a fairly open mind until we get the final text of the bill.
So is the bond market, apparently, with the 30-year edging down maybe 4 basis points from 2.13 to 2.09, and the 10-year basically staying in a range today, remaining in 1.49, 1.48. So, you know, you think when this massive plan would be announced, and again, it's not that massive, you would have yield surging because all this, so many bonds would have to be issued to pay for these programs, but bonds barely budged. So, Ash, what does that mean to you? Does it mean that was the market already pricing this in, or do they not believe that the infrastructure is going to pass?
Yeah, I was just going to say, we had this conversation off camera when we were chatting about it. It seems like it's one or the other, or it's just too early to move the markets to our earlier point. So I guess it's one of those three. Priced in, don't believe it, or too soon to say.
I have to say, I think it's going to pass. You don't see somebody out flanked by senators from two different parties. I saw my local state senator, Kyrsten Sinema, who's not always on Biden's side. You could argue she's the second most conservative member of the Democrat senators, and also Mitt Romney. So I think it's safe to say that it's going to pass. And so really, I think the market had factored in much of this. Like you said, so many people had been telling you, this is going to pass, this is going to pass, Jack. It's just a matter of what exactly is going to be a part of it when it does pass.
That's a good point. While bond yields remained... Oh, Ash, you had a point?
No, I'm sorry. I was going to ask this question. Does the exact constituents of the bill, meaning what the specific funding is, what the levels are, and how it's going to be paid for, and this is an open question, I don't know. I'm curious if you guys have some thoughts. Is that potentially what's preventing the bond market from moving? In other words, we believe it's going to pass, as you pointed out, Samuel, pretty well aligned in terms of having Senator Sinema, Senator Romney on board. But are we waiting to see how it actually gets structured before the bond market moves?
And to that point, one idea that especially the Democrats have pushed quite strongly is increasing funding for the IRS to pay for this bill so that they could audit more people, so that people could be paying, I guess you could say, higher taxes or their fair share of taxes, depending on how you're looking at it. But that would take time as well. You're wondering what's going to fund this in the meantime, whether it is those bonds, because beefing up a government bureaucracy and actually having it be effective, I don't see happening in the short term.
Yeah, one of the great cliches, of course, with infrastructure is shovel ready. And that's usually used in double quotes because it's very difficult to spin up these programs in a quick and effective fashion.
Definitely. And so we have no resolution from the bond market as of yet, but in the equity market, they edged a lot higher, and the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 continued to make all-time highs. Samuel?
Well, I think it was already heading that direction before we got the news later in the day about these stocks. But I think, again, we have to keep on repeating, let's put this all into context. Where we were at this time last week, my first time on air with you guys, we were seeing all the reaction to the Fed. And now, yesterday, I was saying on the show that it looks like we've come full circle in the market. And then other people saying it looks like Chairman Powell has come full circle in the market where we think about inflation. So it is interesting to see, especially with the news that we got here in England today, the Bank of England saying that they're not going to be raising interest rates anytime soon. They're certainly looking more dovish than hawkish. And clearly the market is liking it if you're hitting these all-time highs. It was a good confluence of events.
Samuel, I've got a follow-up question for you. Is the Bank of England thinking about raising rates, or are they thinking about raising rates?
Well, it's interesting because they had one member who's a departing member who was saying that they need to start tapering immediately. And they actually, they dissented against the dissenter in a sense. They really pushed him out. No, there's not so much about the talking about the talking about the talking about. Really, they were saying we're sticking to the plan. We still see, as I've been talking about over and over again on the daily briefing, that really Europe, the UK, we have not caught up to the US, and there's still a lot of recovery that needs to be had here. Just an update on my travel plans. You know, I've been complaining that even if you're vaccinated, they're not giving you anything in return. Finally, the Prime Minister of the UK caving to the pressure from the travel industry and his own Conservative Party and saying, if you have two doses of the vaccine, you'll be able to travel. So I think that's, again, pointing for things in the right direction, but Europe is just not where you guys are in the US.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PIE, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
And but in the U.S., equity markets, you know, are ebullient. However, there is some economic data that could hint at some problems beneath the surface, whether it's a slowdown or true deflation, which, of course, is the Federal Reserve's ultimate fear. Ash, I want to go to you because I'm just looking at the data today. We had jobless claims came in at 411,000 versus 380,000 that was estimated. So that was a miss, worse than expected. Admittedly, continuing claims were slightly better. And then the durable goods order, month over month, expected to be 2.8% month over month change, but it actually came in at a very low 2.3%. What are you making in terms of the economic data? Do you think that this could hint at a little bit of slowdown?
You know, it's such an interesting question. And I was actually looking at the durable goods data myself. So here's what happens. And I actually went through and read the report from the Census Bureau to get a little bit more depth. So the range on this was positive 1% to 4%. Consensus was, depending upon which survey you looked at, generally around 2%. Actual that I saw was up 2.3%. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Prior month was down 1.3%, revised down 0.8%. If you look at the last 13 months, 12 of them were up. Here are the year-over-year numbers. For May, year-over-year, we are up 31.7%. Last month, April, which was revised down to 0.8%, the first number down 1.3%, it was up 45.6%. On a year-over-year basis. So what does all this mean? What's the context here? What does it actually suggest? Well, I would argue that what it suggests is that it shows a economy that is clearly normalizing from the COVID lockdown. And it really kind of makes you wonder, are these data points that useful? Data points like this are very useful when you have a sort of steady state of economic growth or deceleration, and you're measuring data points relatively close. I just don't know that they're really significant at all, Jack. What do you think?
I think that taken by itself, 2.3 on durables versus 2.8, you can't, you know, weave a deflation narrative out of that data set alone. There are some data points that I have seen over the past few days that do give me pause, however, like the U.S. services PMI, which was the biggest miss.
Yeah.
In about 2 years. And I didn't go to the chart back, but it could have been way bigger than that if you go back. But in terms of what was expected, like, I think that the economy is not slowing down, of course not, but the rate of change of growth is slowing down as more people are going back to work, more people have work, more people have already bought the sort of things that they need. Yeah. And I think, you know, you're seeing some ominous rotations in the equity markets where the FANG stocks and the tech stocks are resurging. And of course, growth stocks do well when the economy is not growing. And energy stocks, industrial stocks do well when the economy is growing. So the fact that you have a little bit of a reversal, you know, it makes me think about, could the reflationary period that we have been used to over the past year, could that be giving way to a new regime? Samuel, what do you think?
Well, I want to drill down a little more on the context of what you were saying, Ash. Is the argument that you're making or the point that you're pondering is that because the year-on-year numbers are so stark that it just doesn't give us enough context to really understand these numbers because last year was unlike any year that we've seen? And that's the big difference, that you can't do these year-on-year comparisons, so it doesn't give you the footing to really understand them?
Well, I think clearly the year-over-year comparisons are not especially relevant when you see things up that are nearly 50%. But also, we talk about all of these sort of frictional aspects of labor markets, for example, supply and demand. You know, it's just a bit challenging to understand this because it's not a steady state. So, for example, if you own a factory that produces durable goods, maybe, you know, you've laid off a tremendous number of workers. We know that 2020 was a brutal year. Here we are now in 2021. You're hiring people, you're bringing people back, you're literally cranking up the machines, putting out more output. Is it possible that in the month of May, you look and go, well, maybe we overextended a little bit too far, the pendulum swung a little bit too far in the direction of increasing output. Maybe we need to dial it back a little from where we were in April. These things are very hard to measure. One of the problems, I think, with economic data in general, and many critics of the Fed have made this point far more eloquently than I, is that when you look at these numbers and you say, well, durable goods production was up 2.3% in May. It provides you with this sort of illusion of false precision, like we're measuring something very precisely. Look, these are aggregate numbers for an entire country. When you talk about these numbers with economists, they look at things like trailing averages. They look at a blended series. Like, it's just very difficult to make these distinctions in the best of times. And when you have this in a period like this, I just don't know how much significance you're getting from the data set.
Especially, Ash, when you look at revised numbers. When I first started reporting markets and looking at reports on, you know, monthly reports or quarterly reports, and then you just go back 1 month or one quarter and you see dramatic differences sometimes, it really plays to the narrative that you're laying out here.
Exactly. Exactly. Well said.
Guys, I want to move on to the bank stress tests, which have been released as of 2 minutes ago. And first, I want to explain why they are so important. The Federal Reserve obviously regulates banks, but they regulate their capital ratio, how much risk assets they're allowed to hold relative to their safe assets, and how much equity they can hold relative to their debt. And most importantly, at least in this instance, whether or not they can buy back their own stock or distribute capital to shareholders, whether by buying back stock or by giving out dividends. Giving out dividends, very simple. You just, banks or companies give money to their shareholders. When they buy back stock, they buy back more of the stock, removing some from the float so that current holders actually end up owning more. Interesting today, Samuel, I noticed that the financial sector part of the S&P 500 was the sector that was up the most, 1.31, perhaps not bracing for this news.
Not surprising at all, and you gave me time to get the wire here. Federal Reserve gives U.S. banks a thumbs up on all 23 lenders, easily passing the 2021 stress test, which is, of course, exactly what we thought, which is getting to your point there. Of course, people are looking at increased dividends, buybacks. I think the real question is which institutions then. But one point really stood out to me. Someone was saying, well, yeah, of course they are going to pass the stress test. We had the biggest stress test we could have imagined this past year. The pandemic was the stress test on these institutions. So the real question becomes, are they having to keep too much capital on the books? And is it affecting business, and is it affecting the wider economy when they could be doing more? So all 23 institutions. Ash, I know you have a lot to say on this matter.
Well, you know, this is something that I've been thinking about and covering for a long time. I think the context is really important here. So stress tests are very much a global financial crisis vintage type of regulatory oversight from the federal government. So in addition to the macroprudential components, which are the reserve requirements and the safe asset requirements that Jack just mentioned, as Jack said, this is very much about two things: restrictions on dividends and share buybacks. Now, this is something that, if we remember, was a very emotional issue in the wake of the global financial crisis. In fact, in the UK, it went even further, with the primary regulator there, the Financial Conduct Authority, the FCA, restricting bonuses and executive pay in the post-crisis era. Here's a quick fun fact. In 2008, Goldman Sachs reported net income of $2.3 billion. For the same time period, they paid out $4.8 billion in bonuses, more than double their net income. Okay, so here we find ourselves now in 2021. In 2020, we had more emergency regulatory measures come into play, specifically restrictions on buying back shares and paying share dividends. So now, since April, lenders have borrowed more than $40 billion on the public debt markets, presumably to redistribute, as Jack said, to shareholders in the form of dividends and share buybacks. If you look at the prices of major bank stocks, they're just booming right now. JP Morgan is up about 20% on the year. Goldman Sachs is up nearly 38% year to date. Wells Fargo up 46%. Year to date, there's a projection.
And they got that nice boost from the Fed talking. That just gave them another push.
Yeah, because of the constituency of their lending books. So, and this is all about net interest margins, which is one of the primary ways that banks make money. So now there's a projection in a Reuters story that I read today. I believe it comes from Evercore ISI, which is that Wells Fargo could pay out 167% of its earnings compared to 28% 12 months prior, according to these estimates. Here's why this matters. Here's why it's interesting to me. This is something that has the potential to be tremendously unpopular among Americans, and specifically, and this isn't a value judgment, just a description of understanding where we are today, but particularly among the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, who has effectively run and campaigned against precisely this sort of thing. It sounds like it's the kind of thing that would be catnip for Senator Warren. So the question is, is there a headwind coming for banks from a regulatory perspective, as we might be seeing from tech?
Well, and just to play on that, if you think that would be popular on your side of the pond, imagine over on my side of the pond. And in fact, a lot of the measures that you were referencing from the global financial crisis were actually enacted again, stopping dividends, stopping buybacks last year. I have to disagree, even though I would generally think that you'd be right. I think that Warren and those folks are now so focused, not on the bankers. It's not that they're not the folks du jour anymore. It is so much more about the ultra, ultra rich, the Bezos type of people. The reporting that we've seen from ProPublica about the amount of tax that they pay or don't pay, which I know actually Jack's going to get into a lot. I feel like the current, especially in the progressive wing of the party, specifically based on what Senator Warren has said in the past few weeks, I wonder if the banks might be able to go under the radar, because I think that's a little bit harder for the average American to understand. Or maybe it's just that it's not in the headline so much. And now that Bezos and Amazon are such a part of our lives, that maybe that type of populist tax might go that direction. The banks might be able to slip by.
You know, that really is the question, Samuel. I guess we'll have to see. I would say that tech companies have not been backstopped by the government, which I think is perhaps one of the key drivers of the indignation that we see in the Democratic Party against these kinds of dividend payouts. But we'll have to see. I keep an open mind. But by the way, a perfect segue to talk a little bit more about what's happening in tech.
Samuel, you want to take that on tech?
Yeah, well, I just think here's another important day in tech. I've covered tech for about a decade, and every, 2 weeks, you hear a story about, the government's going to try and regulate tech. Today was another one of those days. So this is something that went through committee, and it's really about what tech companies can do. We're talking about the likes of Google and Amazon advertising their own products on their own platform. So you go to search for a streaming music service, and Google has an ad for their own streaming music service as opposed to Spotify. And that's where a lot of companies, especially folks like Spotify, really think that you get into the overuse of the platform, and they're monopolizing the domination that they really have of their overall platforms. The issue that I see here is that we've been reporting on this every 2 weeks. Even if this is a significant move, even if it comes to pass, the tech giants seem to always be many, many steps ahead. And if you look at the numbers today, for instance, that in spite of something like this passing committee, that you still have the tech stocks surging ahead, rather. It just seems to me like the government can never catch up to the tech companies.
Well, you said it, and I think this sort of whole array, I think there's six different bills that are going through the House. It's very interesting. They are definitely getting the lion's share of the heat from Congress, more than the bankers now. I'm sure Mr. Dimon and company are thrilled to hear that. But I'll throw one other thing out here. I just saw today that new story, breaking story, that Google just announced that they're not going to be phasing out third-party cookies this year, as they'd announced. They announced this in March, they're apparently not going to be able to do that. More than 80% of Google's advertising, 80% of, I should say, Alphabet, the parent company's revenue, comes from advertising. We think of these whiz-bang engineering companies. They make their money the way that the Ed Sullivan Show did, from advertising.
And they thought that they were so big that they wouldn't need cookies, which I think is actually a very valid argument. The problem is, the people who pay them are advertisers who depend on those cookies, maybe not necessarily on the Google platform, but for all the other platforms that they work with. And so they're actually getting pushback from the hand that feeds them, which you never want to bite off.
Exactly. Exactly.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.
If I may enter the conversation, I think that, Samuel, as you alluded to earlier, this story is something that you would encounter every month, or maybe every 2 weeks, if you've been following this. I think that there's always some, oh, this big regulation is just around the corner. Facebook is, they can't do their business model anymore. And what have we seen over the past 5 years, maybe more, is that it never really materialized to anything that that Google or Facebook or Amazon couldn't really deal with. And I think that investors who short the FANG stocks, Amazon, Microsoft, Google, and the like, they do so at their own peril. I was speaking today to Peter Brandt, a chartist, who was looking at the chart of Apple and of Amazon, and he sees some very bullish things. And I think that those stocks are sort of perfectly positioned right now for the murky environment we're in, because if the economy, you know, reopens and we have a great economy, Google's going to make money, Facebook's going to make money from ads. However, if we enter a deflationary window and we take a little jolt in that direction, then you want to buy, investors want to pay a premium for secular growers that aren't subject to the economy. So just looking at the markets, I don't know. I don't think it's necessarily a huge headwind for these companies, at least for now. The question, I agree, Samuel, that you know, these big mega tech platforms, they may be Standard Oil. Of course, that oil giant that was a some people thought a malignant force and an octopus that grappled around every industry. So it may be Standard Oil, but the question is, you know, is it 1907, I think, when they got broken up, or is it 1897 and you have 10 more years of huge secular growth ahead of you?
Well, and I would just say that if somebody were going to break these companies up or put some type of really significant reform on them that really changed the structure of these companies or how they operate, I would say, look to my side of the pond. Look at people like Margaret Vestager in the EU. I think it would be much more likely. And again, it gets back to the political will that Ash was touching on with some of the other stories. I mean, these are giant American companies that are really dominating the market. Here, I just have an Amazon grocery store opening up with, of course, no checkout agents. And that type of pervasiveness of American companies in the European lifestyle, I think it would be, make it much more politically palatable to do, to carry out big regulation. So, of course, we'll be keeping our eyes on that on this side. But as of the moment, nothing to report.
Ash, I want to get back to you because I understand that Tesla has been up something like 9% over the past 2 days, 3.5% today and 5% yesterday. What do you make of this?
Well, you know, Tesla is a volatile stock, obviously. We could have had this conversation. Tesla's up almost 10% in 2 days. That's a conversation we could have had a number of times. I guess it remains to be seen whether this is part of the reopening trade. We know there's a lot of tightness in the used car market, in the new car market. People want to jump in new cars and, you know, drive to the beach this summer, go to a national park, do what they want to do. So it remains to be seen. It's a stock that's volatile. It's kind of like saying Bitcoin is up 10% in 2 days, kind of a standard state of affairs.
Yeah. Before we move on, I just want to say back to the banks, which is that I really do think that banks distributing capital back to shareholders could be deflationary or like bad for the economy and bad for economic growth. Because if you think about it, like banks are levered, what, 10, 15, 20 to one, let's say they're levered 20 to one. If they, you know, pay back in dividends or buybacks $1 billion, that's $20 billion of treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, loans that they can't have on their books. So I think that it's you know, fodder, I'm sure, Ash, for politicians, but I think it really does matter in terms of economic growth. I actually think that on June 30th, so today, June 24th, the Federal Reserve announced their stress test, but the Federal Reserve announces their official announcement on whether they will allow dividends and buybacks at certain levels. I believe it's next Wednesday, June 30th. Before we close, I want to quickly give a shout out to our Festival of Learning on Real Vision, which we are on our second day of. I mentioned my conversation with Peter Brandt, but Ash, you've been having conversations. We have Mike Green, Kyle Bass, Daniel Kahneman, Josh Wolf. All sorts of fascinating people, and you know, that can be seen in the link below. Guys, as we approach a close, I just want to pull up a tweet that I thought was very interesting. You alluded to it earlier, Samuel, and let me just read this tweet. It's about the Roth IRA, which is, of course, a vehicle that people can use to save money, but you can use a certain income cap. It's really for, you know, middle class savings, like $139,000 and less. If you're a very wealthy person, you are not supposed to have a Roth IRA. But this came across the headlines. I want to get your reaction to it. So this tweet: Peter Thiel used fancy footwork to take a Roth IRA, which has a $6,000 annual limit, and spin it into $5 billion. And then that's a huge scandal. One expert told us, how greedy can you get? Guys, what do you make of this tweet? Samuel, what do you go first?
Listen, we're all greedy. And at the end of the day, everybody, including the most liberal folks out there, like Warren Buffett, want to pay the least amount of tax possible. And the one word that's missing in that ProPublica report that I think maybe someone would like to see or think might be there is this illegal? And time again, when you see these tax reports, when you see it from big, even investigative places like ProPublica, and it was perfectly legal. It may not be what it was intended for, but of course, everybody's looking to pay as little tax as possible. So the tax code has to catch up with those people. Again, that's why I think that so much of the focus of people like Elizabeth Warren will be exactly on these types of issues and not the banks. Ash?
Well, you know, it's interesting, precisely right. Peter Thiel is a very careful thinker. I believe he's a Stanford law graduate. I'm sure he's getting very good lawyering and very good advice. It really comes down to a moral and ethical question, I guess, which ultimately is a political question. I don't know. I'm a little skeptical. I think that Elizabeth Warren's can go after both the bankers and the big tech guys at the same time. So we'll have to see. I think the key characteristic of a Roth IRA, by the way, that makes them generally appealing to middle class savers is that generally they are not taxed at the time of distribution. So I'm curious about what the loophole that Mr. Thiel and his people found on that investment.
Yeah, I don't know if he contributed when he was not making so much money, or whether he had so much money, but he wasn't reporting any income. Wink, wink. The Roth IRA is you pay taxes on your income when you earn it in that year, but you don't pay taxes when you can withdraw it, just as you said. And if you think about that, that means that you get to compound as an investor completely tax-free, which is kind of like playing, you know, a very hard video game on cheat mode. Because you could, if you use options and you're up 100%, you pay taxes on none of that. And over the course of 20 years, that can result in some serious, serious returns. So,
If you pay at the time that the funds are committed, you're actually paying taxes before it compounds. So one would think that that would be disadvantageous for long-term compounding. Obviously, it depends on the exact mechanisms and how they were used in this particular case, which we don't yet know. But it'll be an interesting one to follow.
Right. All right. Well, Samuel, Ash, thank you so much. And thank you to everyone who is watching at home. We will see you tomorrow, where Ash hosts Rao on The Daily Briefing.